Campus FM presents a talk in the Work in Progress series, The Protestant Ethic Turns 100. Professor Peter Mayo will give a paper entitled Revisiting Weber's Protestant Ethic, A Critical Exposition.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the first seminar in the 2005-2006 seminar series, Work in Progress in the Social Studies. This seminar series now enters its 10th year. It has always had two main purposes. The first is to, and main purpose, is to provide a forum and an informal atmosphere in which people doing actual research in Malta or any other part of the world, in any branch of the social studies, can present their findings and their ideas before a friendly audience for friendly, if critical, feedback. The second purpose of the series has always been to act as an interface between the public in Malta and the university for the discussion of social issues and problems of critical concern. For example, through the last 3 years, we have had a yearly theme for our seminars. 3 years ago, our theme was Malta and the EU. For the last 2 years, our theme was Malta, immigrants, and the multicultural society. And this provided the opportunity for a number of researchers to present their ideas and for a number of symposia to take place, which discussed the whole issue of Malta and multiculturalism and the whole question whether or not Malta should become a multicultural society. But always, every year, the seminar series is open to researchers who want to give a paper on a wide variety of topics, from history to society to anthropology, and also sociologists of art and literary scholars with social concerns. This year, the seminar series has cause to celebrate, since we do enter our 10th year. The seminar series was founded 10 years ago by David Zamit and myself in 1995-96 and has been going continuously ever since. To celebrate our 10th anniversary, we have arranged three special seminars to kick off the year. These three special seminars are in honor of the centenary of the publication of Max Weber's influential work, The Protestant Ethic and the Spirit of Capitalism. It was first published in 1905. This work is absolutely foundational for both sociology and anthropology. This week, our speaker on the book will be Professor Peter Mayo. Next week, our speaker will be Professor Ursula Apich, who is coming from the J.W. Goethe University in Frankfurt, specifically to address these special seminars. Today, I welcome Professor Peter Mayo of the Faculty of Education. The topic of his paper will be Revisiting Weber's Protestant Ethic, A Critical Exposition. Professor Mayo joins with me in being a convener of the seminar series. Two other conveners are Dr. Mark Anthony Falzone and Dr. Carmel Vassallo. I'm Paul Clow. I head the anthropology division. Professor Peter Mayo is well known in Malta and very well known abroad for his publications in the area of adult education and in the area of critical social theory and how critical social theory can in fact influence the teaching of adults. His first book in 1997 with Godfrey Baldacchino was Beyond Schooling, Adult Education in Malta. In 1999, he published Gramsci, Freire, and Adult Education, Possibilities for Transformative Action with Zed Books in London. That book has been republished in Catalan, In Brazil, it has been republished in Portuguese. It's been recently published by Argument, the German publisher, and it's also been translated into Italian and Turkish. In 2002, with Joseph Buttigieg of Notre Dame University in the United States and Carmel Borge of our own Malta University, Professor Mayo published Gramsci and Education. In 2004, he published Liberating Praxis with Prager Publishers in the United States. His forthcoming book will be with Carmel Borge, Social Learning and Social Difference. So it gives me great pleasure to welcome Peter Mayo to open these three special seminars on the Protestant ethic and the spirit of capitalism. Peter.
Thank you, Paul. I do not need this, right? No. Okay. Just one slight correction about the translations. The German, Turkish, and Italian are still in progress. The German one is ready, actually. Thanks for this very generous introduction. And I'd like to thank you all for coming on not this happiest of days with the kind of weather we have, and also competing activities. We, as Paul was saying, Dr. Paul Clough, we are trying to commemorate, or rather mark, the centenary of a seminal text, a classical text in sociology and social theory, and as we say, also social philosophy. The three are almost intertwined, called The Protestant Ethic and the Spirit of Capitalism, which is one of the classics in social theory, and it is probably the most accessible of Max Weber's works. Now, of course, I don't read German, so I'm basing my essay on the English translation of the work, translated by Talcott Parsons, by the way. Okay, this will be the first of a series, as Paul was saying. I would like to remind our listeners and you present. Next week we have Ursula Appich from the University of Frankfurt, the Goethe Universität of Frankfurt, and also the Institute for Social Research, known as the Frankfurt School. Professor Appich is also cross-appointed to the institute within the same university. And I think something should not be missed, actually, her presentation. And finally, I think Dr. Paul Clough will be presenting on Islam and the spirit of capitalism, right? Am I correct? Okay, so that's our way of marking the centenary. We would have loved to have had other presentations by even Weberian sociologists here in Malta, but unfortunately, pressing engagements prevented them from contributing to this occasion. Okay, the Protestant ethic and the spirit of capitalism. I'm going to provide an exposition of the whole work. I am like a support act in this. Imagine this is a concert. Even though I don't look like, I don't have the appearance of a rock star. But imagine this is a support band prior to the main guest. The main guest will be next week. Okay, and my job is to give you, my task here is to give an overview of the book, assuming that some of people here have not read the book. It's, as I said, it's the most accessible of Weber's works. And the Protestant ethic and the spirit of capitalism, you can follow on the paper I've given you. I'm going to use PE as the acronym for the book. Max Weber sought to explore a possible condition for the emergence of the type of rationality he associates with modern and sober bourgeois capitalism. That's a term that he himself uses. In this work, Weber posits an elective affinity between Protestantism and capitalism. The former might have been a catalyst for the latter's development. Notice my use of the word might, possible, etc. That's very much a reflection of Weber's own style, which is very tentative at times. This paper provides a critical exposition of Weber's theory. It is divided into three sections. The first consists of an outline of Weber's argument. Here's a support act. It is followed by a discussion on the methodology he employs, and the paper is concluded with a brief critique of this 100-year-old essay. The argument, or rather, my presentation of the argument, because people could present it differently. Weber intriguingly proposes a relationship between Protestantism and capitalism at the very outset, when he establishes a connection between socio-economic location and religious affiliation. He starts off by saying, in his introduction, he talks about the Occident, the West, that is, and what has been often referred to as Occidentalism, as opposed to Orientalism in Edward Said. Occidentalism in the sense that he glorifies the West, where he says, look, we had this kind of thing in Babylonia, etc., but in Europe it was different, it was more rational. It was more developed, etc. He gives lots and lots of examples. But he also establishes a connection between socio-economic location and religious affiliation. He points out that entrepreneurs, the most highly skilled workers, and the most technically equipped industrial personnel are of Protestant denomination in his time. Now, Weber was born towards the end of the 19th century, and died in the first part of the 19th century, of the 20th century, at the age of 56. For those of you who are not familiar with Weber's work, Weber was also a man who wrote immensely. I mean, he's got quite a corpus of writings, sociological writings, legal training. He had legal training himself, was a lawyer by profession, but with a great interest in history. Develops a very strong historical style, historical mode of research. But most important of all, he was also a man who was very much involved in the public sphere. In fact, he was involved in many things, including the drafting of the Constitution for the Weimar Republic. So he was involved in the drafting of the Weimar Constitution. So this is the sort of man we're talking about. Tremendous interests. I mean, you can see from his work, he dabbles into architecture, history, political economy, you name it, philosophy, etc. He is very much, even though he spent his best years in the first part of the century, the 20th century, he was a typical grand old man, you would say, of the 19th century in that respect. I doubt whether modern universities, I was discussing this with Dr. Darmanin this morning, my colleague, whether universities today, with these kind of reforms, are going to keep producing these kind of people. But anyway, we'll see. That's another argument. So, back to the argument now, the argument. Weber intriguingly poses a relationship between what Protestantism and capitalism at the outset when he establishes a connection between socio-economic location and religious affiliation. He points out that entrepreneurs, the most highly skilled workers, and the most technically equipped industrial personnel are of Protestant denomination. The same applies to other spheres of activity, such as the universities and different levels of the occupational ladder, where Protestants are seen by Weber to predominate in the industrial technical areas, while Catholics are mostly to be found in the traditional ones. This, for Weber, constitutes an anomaly, since it is usually the case that minority groups on the periphery of political life channel their efforts in the direction of commercial enterprise. Weber concludes, therefore, that the main explanation for such differences in occupation between Protestants and Catholics could well lie not only in the nature of their present historic political circumstances, but also in their religious beliefs. It is here that Weber sets about the task of tracing the connection between a spirit of enterprise, which viewed superficially suggests a lax attitude towards spiritual matters, and the religion, which is considered by Weber to entail greater rigor than Catholicism. His first step is that of conveying what he considers to be the essence of the spirit of modern capitalism, and of revealing the manner in which it distinguishes itself from traditional modes of economic enterprise. He then proceeds by showing the affinity that he believes it has with the kind of moral and social behavior engaged in by members of the different Protestant sects. In his discussion on the spirit of capitalism, Weber indicates that certain capitalistic traits and others that, in his view, are mistakenly associated with capitalism, for example, acquisitive gain, were inherent in other social formations. Such traits existed in India, Babylon, China, in ancient Greece and Rome, and in medieval Europe. Furthermore, what he calls adventure or booty capitalism has been, in Weber's view, a feature of different kinds of societies. Booty capitalism for him was something which was not methodical. It was something just like what the conquistadors did. You know, capture a precious stone, whatever, etc., and take it with you, etc. That's booty capitalism. It's more rapacious in that respect. It was considered by Weber to be that kind of capitalism. Was considered by Weber to be irrational, speculative, and often related to acquisition by force and exploitation of conquered people. Well, here you've got the explanation. Acquisition by force and exploitation of conquered people. This kind of capitalism is considered by Weber to be quite traditional. Traditionalism also manifests itself amongst workers on piece rate, who would feel disinclined to work harder than is necessary for them to satisfy their economic needs. This traditional kind of enterprise is at odds with the spirit of modern capitalism, or sober bourgeois capitalism, as manifest in Weber's time, the essence of which consists, among other things, in a complete devotion to earning, as Anthony Giddens would put it. Earning becomes an end in itself. In modern capitalism, it does not constitute the means for acquiring immediate satisfaction. And we consider here the parallel with bourgeois schooling, where you can postpone gratification so that you can spend years of study and hard work at school and then gain your gratification later. The modern capitalist is conceived of by Weber as an ascetic, in that the income acquired is not for personal use and therefore does not serve as the key to ostentatious living. The quotation, and of course Weber is very much rooted in an ethnocentric view of the world, Eurocentric and patriarchal, etc. Man is dominated by the making of money, he says, he writes, by acquisition as the ultimate purpose of his life. Economic acquisition is no longer subordinated to man as the means for the satisfaction of his material needs. End of quote. That's from the Protestant Ethic. So I continue here. Contrary to the speculative kind of capitalistic enterprise, modern capitalism is characterized by a methodical approach to production. Its dominant feature is that of rationalization, the key term in Weber. And I quote from the Protestant Ethic. It is one of the fundamental characteristics, Weber tells us, of an individualistic capitalist economy that it is rationalized on the basis of rigorous calculation, directed with foresight and caution towards the economic success which is sought in sharp contrast to the hand-to-mouth existence of the peasant and to the privileged traditionalism of the guild craftsman and of the adventurer's capitalism. Adventurer's capitalism and booty capitalism go together for Weber. Oriented to the exploitation of political opportunities and irrational speculation, end of quote. So acquisition for its own sake, postponement of gratification, and rationalization constitute for Weber the hallmarks of modern capitalist society. Now, having described what he considers to be the essence of modern capitalism, Weber engages in the process of demonstrating how it is commensurate with what he regards as the basic tenets of Protestantism. He commences his task by discussing the Protestant notion of the calling, Beruf in German. Now, Weber attributes the concept of Beruf to Luther. What Weber considers novel about Luther's conception of the calling is that the fulfillment of duty in the world began to be regarded as the highest form of moral conduct in the world, not apart from the world, which was the case with the Middle Ages in the monasteries. Weber describes how, according to this conception, only through fulfillment of worldly duties does one observe God's will. This marked a decisive break with the medieval idea of monastic contemplation. Weber was to write in General Economic History, and I quote, "The dropping of the monastic ideals by the Lutheran Reformation meant the disappearance of the dualistic distinction between a universally binding morality, so people are bound by a certain morality, and an especially demanding code for virtuosi." The virtuosi are the monks in the cloisters, okay? "The otherworldly asceticism came to an end. The fervent religious individuals who would have gone into the monasteries had now to practice their religion in ordinary life." Here's a big break with Catholicism, quite a contrast with Catholicism. So now you have to work, you have to follow this ascetic rule as a citizen outside in the real world. Remember the famous dictum by Wycliffe, before the Reformation, the Middle Ages, that nobody stand between man's conscience and God. Whereas in Catholicism, as we know, before Vatican Council II, people would interpret theology for you. Theological, they will interpret and explain the faith to you. Remember the problems that, for example, George Breker had in the beginning of the century. By trying to teach religion to ordinary people, he was incurring the wrath of those who obviously took it upon themselves to interpret religion for others, mainly the elite, which was the church, the ecclesiastical elite, who were the virtuosi in that particular context. Weber argues that despite, now this, the quote is over, right? The Weber argues that despite his emphasis on worldly activity, Luther provides a traditionalistic conception of the calling. It was based on the idea of accepting one's station in life as a divine ordinance. Now, this is not really capitalistic in that respect. So you have to accept your station in life, okay? Your God-given place, which was used a lot, even in the colonies, by the way, by English colonialists and their missionary, complementary missionary contingents, when they used to tell people, you've got to accept your divinely ordained place in the scheme of things. Now, Luther had this. It was based on the idea of accepting one's station in life as a divine ordinance. Restraint, in accordance with the limits of one's station, was advocated, in the words of Stephen Zeidman, his book, Liberalism and the Origins of European Social Theory. Weber viewed Lutheranism as a type of mystical world religion, which cultivates a naive emotionalism and is rooted in a traditionalistic practical orientation. According to Weber, what is missing from Luther's conception of the calling is the motivation to better oneself and the devotion to earn more. Not remain in your God-given place, but to better yourself and the devotion to earn more. The two being so central to the capitalist spirit. The situation is therefore as traditionalistic as that of the workers referred to earlier, who fitted away the opportunity to work harder and therefore earn more. In Weber's view, the congenial ethos for the development of the capitalist spirit had to be generated by other sources of Protestantism. He felt that most of the sects, whom he describes in the penultimate chapter of the Protestant Ethic, made a contribution in this regard. He argues, however, penultimate chapter, he gives us the whole different sects within Protestantism, okay, who have contributed in some way to the development of the capitalist spirit. But he argues that it was Calvinism that provided the strongest impact. The discussion on Calvinism occupies the greater part of the section of the essay. Weber shows how the Calvinist deity was perceived as a transcendental being whose ways were incomprehensible to the human mind. The Calvinists maintained that God, whose decrees are immutable, decides everyone's fate. They believed that a person's destiny is predetermined, and that only a few persons can be saved and join the elect. Unlike Catholicism, Calvinist preaching maintained that a person cannot be saved through confessions. There was no way of attaining grace for those to whom God decided to deny it. Calvin's followers must have been apprehensive about their fate. Doubts as to one's fate would have been regarded as a sign of damnation. good works in the real world for the glorification of God would have served to rid persons of the fear of damnation. What must have been of central importance to Weber in the light of this thesis is that the Calvinist God required that such works be carried out within a unified, rationalized system. The conduct had to be rational and methodical. Other features congenial to the capitalist ethic included the concept of the calling that leads to calling as beruf, as vocation, if you like, that leads to over-specialization, so central to a process of rationalized capitalist production. Now, let's make it clear, Weber is here talking specifically about the Western world, not about other civilizations. He's talking specifically about the Western world. He makes this very clear in the introduction, the preface. Calvinism developed this idea in a manner that renders it different from that enunciated by Luther. A person can have different callings. According to Weber, failure to respond to one that is more profitable would have been regarded as a very serious shortcoming. Woe betide you if you don't use your talents. And here we have the parable of the talents in our Gospels, right? The parable of the talents. According to Weber, failure to respond to one that is more profitable would have been regarded as a serious shortcoming by Calvinists. The idea of mobility and expansion, so essential to the capitalist ethic, is conveyed here. When linked with the notion of deferring gratification, Calvinists displayed a negative attitude towards anything that pertained to the flesh, that belonged to the flesh, and all that was sensuous about culture. So when linked to this, it leads, according to Max Weber, to what he regarded as a key capitalist principle: accumulation of capital to ascetic consumption to save. The affinity is more or less established. Weber's central argument, however, is that over a considerable period of time, these economic ethics, which were originally meant to serve as the means to a particular end, that is, the glorification of God, became ends in themselves. So at first, there was a strong religious element. You have to engage yourself in work, keep working, saving and accumulating capital, because that's the only way we can show that you are amongst the elect. And ultimately, you do this for the glorification of God. However, what happened was, as always, religion eventually moves away, and the whole thing becomes, the accumulation of capital becomes an end in itself. It's almost like looking at, how ironic I'm going to mention this, because I'm going to mention something which is more part of the Counter-Reformation rather than the Reformation. Baroque painting, which is very much a part of the Counter-Reformation, anti-Protestant in the respect. Baroque painting and sculpture and architecture had a very strong religious fervor. The work of Bernini, for example, in Rome, and of Borromini, etc., are all classical cases of an element which is part of the Counter-Reformation. That is why you get representations like the Ecstasy of St. Teresa. Okay? They had to capture that ecstatic experience. But what happened was, it was taken up by rulers in the north of Europe and in Belgium, etc., and Antwerp, and it was ultimately became flaccid in the hands of a Peter Bohr Rubens, because it no longer had that religious element in it. So what happens once, there's at one stage you have this religious impetus that gets lost, and then the whole thing is, once it loses that religious impetus, it changes its nature in that respect. So we can make a parallel with a Counter-Reformation thing, which is the Baroque in that respect. Look at the way Italian Baroque developed in the 17th century and see how it developed elsewhere in Belgium, where that religious fervor was lost. Peter Paul Rubens' studio is a classical example. The same thing, Weber saying the same thing happened with Protestantism and Catholicism. There was a Protestant impetus, but that was eventually lost. So his central argument, I repeat, is that over a considerable period of time, these economic ethics which were originally meant to serve as the means to a particular end, which is the glorification of God, became ends in themselves. They no longer served as a, quote, a light cloak, which could be cast aside, but gradually degenerated into a lion cage, a heartless and spiritless process of rationalization, of mechanized petrification. So once that fervor is lost, that religious fervor is lost, all you get is mechanization, routinization, something which loses its original spirit. It becomes routine. Rationalization, mechanized petrification. This is a common Weberian tenet that can be found in many of his writings, notably those concerning the nature of bureaucracy. The transition has been from a value-oriented action, Weltrational, to a completely goal-oriented rational action, Zweckrational. Now, Zweckrationalität, now I left out the two dots on top because I couldn't find the German punctuation. Zweckrationalität refers to the kind of action in which the end, the means, and the secondary results are all rationally taken into account and weighed. I'm quoting Derek Sayre here from his book Capitalism and Modernity, an excursus on Marx and Weber. Weltrational action refers to the situation when an absolute end is pursued entirely for its own sake and independently of any prospects of external success. Having now exposed Weber's argument, I now turn to an analysis of the methodology he employs in this essay. So that's the argument. Now, the method. Throughout his essay, Weber employs a comparative historical mode of analysis. He moves back and forth in history to trace the development of Protestant asceticism and the different ideas, what he calls the switchman of history, that could have influenced its course. He also moves across cultural boundaries with a view to exploring conditions that may have had a bearing on Western capitalist development and identifying the particular features that distinguish such a society from others. This is precisely what he does with respect to the issue of rationalism, so fundamental to his analysis of the emergence of Western capitalism, where he attempts to show that it is essentially a feature of Western society. The Protestant Ethic was to be the key text in a series of essays, on the religions of different societies. One of the things you have with classical sociology, you have a lot of unfinished work, huge volumes of unfinished work. Marx is the classic example, so is Durkheim. Weber is no exception to this situation. So the Protestant Ethic was to be the key text in a series of essays on the religions of different societies. It could therefore be seen as having constituted part of an incomplete comprehensive project. Again, this project involves a historical and comprehensive analysis, which is intended to show that despite their material bases, these civilizations did not produce the kind of instrumental rationality which is a feature of different aspects of Western society, and which he believes contributed towards Western society's dynamism. So he wanted to show comparatively how other societies differed from Western society in terms of not having the kind of instrumental rationality, which also affects our thinking, by the way, what the people from the Frankfurt School would call instrumental reasoning. A task of this kind necessitated a multidisciplinary analysis on Max Weber's part. This type of analysis is very much in evidence in the Protestant Ethic. It is a key feature of the methodology used. Although he is dealing primarily with the issues of religion and economics, Weber draws on a wide range of subjects to drive home his point. Now, which subjects does he draw on? They are legion. They include theology, economics, social philosophy, music, architecture, mathematics, bookkeeping, and history. And did I leave out anthropology? I don't know. His work is full of erudition, and this serves to project the image of Weber, as I said earlier on, as very much the cultivated man whose demise he anticipates and laments, both in this work, The Protestant Ethic, and elsewhere. For example, in his short piece, which I suggest the education students here to read, called On the Rationalization of Education and Training. This, he felt, is all part and parcel of the process of rationalization of Western capitalist society, a process which necessitates the production and certification of specialists. Weber sees the gradual emergence of a heartless, freedom-curtailing rationalization process as part of the evolution of Western society. As Louis Kozer, which is, by the way, North America's standard undergraduate sociology text, as Louis Kozer points out, however, Weber, it's called Masters of Sociological Thought, this text, Weber does not conceive of this evolutionary historical shift in purely structural terms. Unlike such writers as, those who are familiar with sociology would know these, Emil Durkheim, who talks about the transition from mechanical to organic solidarity, Main, who talks about the transition from status to contract, and Twenies, I don't know how you pronounce that, Ferdinand Twenies talks of loss of Gemeinschaft, community, and Gesellschaft, the transition from Gemeinschaft to Gesellschaft, in his classic work, Gemeinschaft und Gesellschaft. One is a community spirit, one is more role-taking, association kind of spirit, right? On the contrary to these, Weber regards shift in human action as lying at the basis of such of shifts in human action as lying at the basis of such social transitions. The Protestant ethic tends to confirm this view. It is human action, the result of changes in religious conduct that influence changes in economic action. The focus of his study concerning the process of increasing rationalization in Western society. The focus on human action is central to what is known in Germany, or what was known in Germany as the Wittgenstein approach, which is basically a process of analysis very much associated with Weber and others. It is a process which entails an interpretative understanding of human behavior. Wittgenstein, an interpretative understanding of human behavior. One which necessitates an attempt on the researcher's part to enter the world of and empathize with the actor. Now, Weber attempts to do this on the Protestant ethic. A case in point is when he tries to imagine the kind of psychological pressure. Remember what I said earlier on, you don't know if you are amongst the elect, so you do good works. The kind of psychological pressure that Calvinists must have faced because of their inner loneliness. No one could intervene on their behalf to secure them God's grace. Because what we have here is a very individualizing notion of religion. It's you and God, with nobody in between. Weber poses such apparently obvious questions as, this is the anxiety that one feels. Am I one of the elect? And how can I be sure of the state of grace, according to Calvin? It is through such questions that Weber sought to empathize with the Calvinist. He then goes on to examine the options open to such people and uses in this process what is known as interpretative understanding. Again, Wittgenstein, interpretive understanding, to arrive at some causal explanation. What causes what? Weber did not draw on case studies when engaging in interpretive understanding in this particular work, The Protestant Ethic. Instead, he employed a key conceptual tool, one that is immediately associated with him, namely the ideal type. This is well known in German social theory, the ideal type. You create an ideal type. We tend to do it a lot in education, the ideal teacher, right? What kind of teacher do we want? So we create an ideal type. The ideal type. This is very much part of the German tradition. From the writings of leading authorities in the various Protestant sects, he sought to create conceptions of ideal Calvinists and other exemplars of ascetic Protestantism. He used what he held to be the basic tenets of their writings and preaching to draw out their implications for everyday moral conduct. Elsewhere, in his discussion on the capital spirit, he draws not only on the writings of such figures as Franklin, but on some outstanding German examples, and in the case of the Putterout, which is a detail he goes into, from knowledge of workplace conditions. The Putterout is people from peasants would take their cloths to a particular town. You have this Putterout who is in contact with middlemen, and then they go and search for customers. What happens then eventually, I can't go into the details, I can't even remember the details, but he basically explains that how this Putterout situation then was eventually overtaken by others who could produce at a faster rate. So this one, and by the way, they've got a mistake, that's not chapter 11, it's chapter 2, written in Roman letters, supposedly, chapter 2, right? So there's this whole case. The historical and religious personages that provide the sources for the creation of ideal Protestant types are very much the charismatic authorities. Most religions would have a charismatic authority at first, and then that charisma gets lost. Christ, Saul, Paul of Tarsus, etc. Calvin, okay? You always have these charismatic authorities. In Vapor's work, these figures must have served a purpose. They seem to have provided a source of contrast to processes of institutional rationalization. Once that charisma is lost and the fervor gets lost, what you get in its place is routinization. So you've got the drabness of a routinized process contrasted with the charisma of its origins. And that's what normally happens. Charismatic authority dies, figure dies, eventually the whole system continues, but in a very routinized way. It is to such figures, prophets as Weber calls them, that Weber appeals, albeit half-heartedly, in his beautiful, poetical, final depiction of a heartless, routinized world. This final passage of Weber's essay, with its strongly value-laden words, reflecting the author's disenchantment with the type of society he saw emerging, highlights the kind of tension that underlies his writing. He seems to be torn between scientific detachment and emotional involvement. Any reader who overlooks this aspect of Weber's work is finally made aware of it by Weber himself, who, after projecting such somber images as that of the iron cage of specialists, and then of specialists without spirit, and of a civilization which is virtually a nullity, and I'm quoting him, quote unquote, he makes a conscious effort to keep such emotions in check. So here, towards the end, he's got a very poetic piece. Very emotional, presenting a very bleak scenario. But then all of a sudden he puts himself in check. It's interesting, the style, that is very, very interesting style. And he tries to hold his values in abeyance and makes a statement to this effect, that, you know, he has to be in control. He can't allow his emotions to be given expression. Such a concern on his part is understandable, since while acknowledging the value-bound problem choices, this is typical, this is key to Weber's methodology, while acknowledging the value-bound choices, problem choices, of the investigator, when you choose something to research, okay, your values come into play. Why am I going to research this and not something else? And you may have a hunch that because of your politics, your position, your location, etc., that your research will go in a certain direction. However, Weber believed that the methods of sociological inquiry could be value-free. So in other words, what emerges from your research will be very contrary to what you expected and might also go against your own feelings and your own original feelings, which led you to research this thing in the first place. Okay? I don't know if I'm clear, if I made this clear. Now, some final critique. While Weber's methodology is generally considered to be central to an understanding of the analytical project he sets forward, there are many other aspects of the Protestant ethic that warrant some critical commentary. I shall now deal with a few of them. In this essay, because this book is virtually an essay, as well as in other works by Max Weber, one notices a contribution to that area of sociological inquiry known as the sociology of knowledge. Like Marx, Weber sees ideas as having a close relationship with economic interests. Now, the relationships between Marx and Weber have been explored in many works. Probably the most famous of them all is Karl Lowitz, Max Weber und Karl Marx, Max Weber and Karl Marx. More recently, we've had Derek Sayers' Capitalism and Modernity, an excursus on Marx and Weber. So like Marx, Weber sees ideas as having a close relationship with economic interests. However, it is clear from this work, The Protestant Ethic, that Weber does not subscribe to certain crude Marxist interpretations, normally referred to as vulgar Marxism, that are generally of an evolutionary economic determinist nature. Let me explain for those who are not familiar with Marx's works. Marx always spoke in various works, and sometimes the emphasis shifts, but the relationship between what is the economic base and the world of ideas, base and superstructure. Okay? Now, basically, the two are in relationship with each other. There's an element of reciprocity, there's a dialectical relationship between the two. That often got interpreted, and sometimes also because Marx and Engels emphasized this point, to go against the idealists who started the other way around. It was ideas, it was from heaven to earth. Now, they would say, not from heaven to earth, but from earth to heaven. They were talking about the dialectical relationship, but what happens is that sometimes by overemphasizing the economic, that lends itself to an interpretation that ideas are dependent on the economic base, what we call epiphenomena. Okay? Now, that's what is known as an economic determinist theory. Okay? Now, Weber refers to such interpretations, these crude renderings of Marx ideas, or rather crude Marxist interpretations, he refers to them as naive historical materialism. Historical materialism is what is associated with Marxism. He indicates that though an elective affinity exists between ideas and the economic base, the former, that is the ideas, are not regarded as epiphenomena. That means emanations of the latter, things which emerge from the base, but enjoy a life of their own. As Weber indicates throughout this thesis, ideas can generate an ethos that can influence the course of economic development. Certain readings of Marx, especially those concentrating on Marx's early writings, to which Weber could not have gained access the time when he lived, and some later formulations, including a series of letters written by Engels, emphasize a dialectical relationship between base and superstructure. At the close of the Protestant Ethic, Weber expresses the need for some kind of dialectical relationship between religious ideas and the economy. He states that it is necessary to investigate how Protestant asceticism was in turn influenced in its development and its character by the totality of social conditions, especially the economic. So he's not just saying one-way traffic. He's not just saying how Protestantism only influenced the spirit of capitalism, but also how capitalism also influenced the totality of social conditions, including economic conditions, influenced Protestantism in turn. The relationship being positive, therefore, is one of reciprocity, as our friend Dr. Gloria Lauri-Lucente would want to emphasize. Weber's work is characterized by its groping and tentative nature. This is typical of Weber. He is very cautious about the issue of causality. You see, the problem with sociologists, there's always another sociologist with an axe behind you. So you've got to be very, very careful and tentative. He's very cautious about the issue of causality, that is to say, about positing a direct deterministic relationship between Protestant asceticism and capitalism. This work is only one, the Protestant Ethic that is only one of several studies by Weber in which he examines various factors that could have helped generate conditions congenial to capitalist development. It's true, in other words, he goes into other things. It therefore forms part of a multivariate analysis of these conditions. There are moments in the text, however, when Weber abandons caution and formulates such categorical statements as, and I quote, "It, the Puritan outlook, favored the development of rational bourgeois economic life. It was the most important and, above all, the only consistent influence in development of that life. It stood at the cradle of the modern economic man. Never mind woman. By the way, so here caution is thrown to the wind. As this paper hopefully has shown, the ideas which Weber acknowledges as having had an affinity with the spirit of capitalism were derived, for the most part, from leading charismatic authorities. Now, these led to the creation of ideal types. Okay, ideal types were intended to serve as conceptual tools against which the action of ordinary human beings could be measured. However, there are no case studies in the Protestant ethic which serve to show how the actual moral behavior of the ordinary Protestant ascetic measured against these types. This is a point which Parkin, in his work on Max Weber, has raised. For example, how were the meanings contained in the text or sermon by a Calvin or a Wesley circulated socially and mediated amongst members of the congregation? To what extent did Calvin's followers, for instance, interpret differently, in accordance with their social location, the teachings of their spiritual leader? This would be interesting when you compare the situation with what went on. Paul, you know this very well, you have been in Nigeria, in Africa. How would the teachings of a charismatic authority transferred to Africa via missionaries get reinterpreted in a situation, a spirit of hybridity, by the locals, to become mixed also with their own traditional rituals? So, but let's stick to the Western world. To what extent did Calvin's followers, therefore, interpret differently in accordance with their social location the teachings of their spiritual leader? We don't have any clue here. Given the nature of Weber's analysis, an essentially historical one, these issues could not have been dealt with adequately, unless he really goes deep into empirical life history research. As for the thesis advanced by Weber, one feels inclined to ask how he would have accounted for the emergence of modern capitalism in the northern Italian region of Piemonte, which was already very industrialized in Weber's time. It also had a well-developed and highly mobilized industrial proletariat. Piedmont had no Protestant ascetic tradition. If anything, it was predominantly Catholic at the time. Also worth exploring, with respect to Weber's thesis, is why did not Protestantism have any effect in terms of industrialization on a country like Scotland, that's where Calvin landed, where this religion makes its presence strongly felt. A similar question that emerges with respect to the relevance of Weber's thesis for more recent times is whether Protestantism had any effect on the industrial development of South Korea. One third of the country is Protestant, and many Protestants figure prominently in commercial circles. How does one account for Japan's economic rise, considering that Christianity was rejected there from the very start? And once this paper has begun to focus on non-European countries, it would be worth looking at the issue of colonialism. Weber seems to overlook the part which colonialism played in the process of modern capitalist development. His discussion on colonialism is very limited in this essay. One feels, however, that Weber's thesis could have benefited from a thorough analysis of the colonization process and its contribution to Western capitalist development. In a world characterized by dependencies, such an analysis would have been most relevant. It would have been interesting to explore the role which Protestant asceticism played in colonial politics, and it did play a very important role. It would be likewise interesting to explore what kind of Protestantism best suited colonial interests. The literature on education in basically economically developing countries, is replete with statements by British politicians and officials to the effect that natives, quote-unquote, should be provided with the skills to labor effectively in their God-given place. The quote is not God-given place. Such statements call to mind Luther's limited conception of the calling. I had referred to this earlier on. I'm soon done. This is my last paragraph, but a lengthy one. The issues of colonization and the industrialization process in Southeast Asia may be taken as an indication that Weber's thesis can be inspiring enough to stimulate ideas that could be of great relevance to the contemporary researcher. Yet, as far as I'm concerned, the most enduring aspect of this work is his final pessimistic vision of humanity, hemmed in among the stultifying, rationalized institutional forces. The intense sense of disenchantment and helplessness conveyed by Weber in this scene is one which bears comparison with Blake's darker poems or Thomas Hardy's poetic but largely depressing novels, the latter writer having been a contemporary of Weber with whom he shared a very strong Nietzschean influence. It is a sense of smothered humanity that one obtains in this piece. It is a situation from which there seems to be no way out. Throughout his analysis, Weber places the emphasis on human action and therefore on the role of agency in relation to structure. However, he projects a final image of society that tends to deny agency a critical role. The essay leaves me with this feeling, unless I take seriously the faint hope a resigned Weber places in future prophets, charismatic authorities, who, in this particular instance, appear to assume the role of a deus ex machina more than anything else. What I am left with, in the end, is an account of a process of rationalization, bereft of any language of possibility. End of argument.
Thank you very much, Peter, for an extremely wide-ranging coverage of what is in fact a relatively small book, because as readers of the book and sociologists know very well, Max Weber's book operates at so many different levels and raises not merely historical questions of cause and effect, but much more general questions of how we can study or know anything at all about each other, about society. That in fact, as Peter indicates so very, very well, in part two of his talk, Methodology, and part three of his talk, Critique, Weber is not just giving us a historical account of the origins of capitalism in possibly Protestantism, he's also giving us an epistemology of how it is we can possibly come to know what it is like to be either a Protestant or a capitalist, or the relationships between them. So you've raised a large number of interesting questions about Max Weber, and I think your ending suggestion was very, very interesting, because at the end you suggest that Weber begins with a portrait of the Protestant as the agent, the willing person, the volitional actor who changes human society because he has changed his belief, he has converted to a new form of Christianity. But you go on to suggest that for Weber, this had turned into a highly determined structural universe, and therefore the only way out of the iron cage of discipline and hard work promoted by Protestantism is by the emergence of some new charismatic figure. So we find that Weber is beginning by stressing agency in human life, ends by stressing a new form of determinism, which almost parallels Marx's determinism, and is left by no way out except the idea of some new great world historical individual will come along with a new set of beliefs which might inspire a new change.
But that's a desperate invocation, nothing more. The call to prophets, new prophets, is just a desperate invocation. It's a deus ex machina. I think he's very, very pessimistic, very Hardy in that sense. In that respect, Thomas Hardy is very pessimistic. I don't think he sees any way out of the iron cage. It is also, as we will hear next week, very much a critique of capital in that respect. What he sees, and this was in the first part of the century, a sense of mechanized petrification was the argument he uses. So it's a very pessimistic ending. Not rare in the German tradition, by the way. There's a footnote in my paper which goes like this. The feelings towards modern society conveyed by Max Weber in his final section are in keeping with the German tradition that hankered after the past. Weber seems to be lamenting the loss of a world characterized by feeling, values, and spirit. This is very much within the tradition that incorporates the work of Ferdinand Twenys, who regarded Gemeinschaft as the more natural world when opposed to Gesellschaft. Gesellschaft is what we have now, roles, association, etc., Gemeinschaft is a sense of community which has been lost, especially as people moved into the cities. And, you know, there's always this hankering after this lost world. It stands in contrast to some of the work within the French tradition. So, for example, Durkheim sees modern society characterized by organic solidarity as the more desirable one when compared to traditional society characterized by mechanical solidarity. It is very much part of the German tradition, always hankering to some golden age, the age of Goethe, for instance. You also find different variations of this, where people like, for example, George Steiner, after Nazism, after the Nazi experience, talks about, yes, the modern-day German is a miracle in the death of language, but the language of Germany today is not the language of Goethe. This is after the Nazi experience, of course. It's no longer the language of Goethe, it's no longer the language of Thomas Mann. There's always this hankering. It became more pronounced after the Nazification experience, of course. That is very, 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 very typical. So Weber's position is very typical within the German tradition in that regard.
So, Peter, what can we salvage of Weber in a context which is, you know, secularized and multicultural?
What can we salvage? Definitely, what's interesting. It raises many, there are many issues we can tackle. I see a lot of Weber in what's going on, for example, in the field in which we work, education today. We hear a lot about the technical, rational mode in education, right? We have many people from the education field here. Technical rationality. Everything is standardized. Look at the reforms we are having. All these standardized. Everything is marked in terms of numbers, etc., blah, blah, blah. So there's a lot of Weber there to be seen, and that ties in also with his analysis of bureaucracy. Okay, the bureaucratization of the world. I don't think we disagree on this. We live this every day. This institution is a classic example, how everything has been taken over by bureaucracy. I think there's a lot of Weber in that. In this day and age, very challenging. What's happened to the Protestant ethic today? Okay, what about the United States, and especially Jesus Land? Okay, where we see a new form of, well, Protestant ethic, which is now governing U.S. politics. I wouldn't say that this is exactly what Weber was addressing in his particular issue. However, it is worth considering. Is there some kind of affinity or elective affinity, as you put it? I don't know what the elective thing stands for, but anyway, affinity between, for example, the kind of Protestantism, and Paul can help us out here, being an American himself, the kind of Protestantism we get on the television, the God channels, etc., right? And which many of us have seen also in North America. And, is there a work ethic being promoted? What kind of notion is being promoted? How much of the Protestant ethic has remained? For instance, how do we look at people who don't work? Either because they're single parents and they rely on social security, how do we look at them? Has the Protestant ethic affected the way people look at quote-unquote parasites? Okay, and I wonder whether this kind of thinking, which may have survived, which makes non-work not just undesirable, but to be ashamed of. I've heard people in England say, I faced the humiliation of being on the dole. I've seen this. I wonder whether elements of the Protestant ethic are still being felt there. Or, for example, the idea that you have to work out there. You should not be a parasite. Interesting, for example, a novel like Dickens, Great Expectations, the whole irony of being a gentleman, whether Dickens was reworking the Protestant ethic. Whether these kind of thinkings today serve to continue the kind of neoliberal policies that we have right now, which consists primarily of an attack on the welfare state. The whole idea of the relationship between Protestant ethic, for example, and the demise of the welfare state today. I don't know. I think it's premature to say that, you know, the things that Weber has been talking about are very much now resurfacing in the United States. I think that there are, I would be very, very, very hesitant. I would be a Weber in that respect. I'd be tentative in that respect to suggest this. But it's worth exploring. And today, Paul and I were discussing the whole issue of the Protestant ethic, which you know very well in America, and the idea of employment and people who don't work for a variety of reasons, depending on social security. Now, if you have this kind of attitude, that these people are parasites, blah, 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 then that will all continue to cement the current policy, which marks the later stage of capitalist development, which often consists of an attack on the welfare state. I don't know if I've answered this to your satisfaction, but it's something I've been toying with. I want to see whether there's some relevance today. People use the word Protestant ethic today to define American policies, but I think the term is being used rather loosely. I don't know, Paul, do you have anything to say about this from your own American experience?
Well, my tendency is to answer that again by repeating what I said earlier, that I think Weber is an extremely complex thinker. I think that while one can spend a lifetime studying Marx or Durkheim, I think that to understand the lines of their thought is so much easier. You very rightly said that Weber had no access to the early Marxian writings when he wrote this book, and a key question is whether he, like Durkheim, were replying to the ghost of Marx. Some of you have read, I'm sure, Anthony Giddens' famous expression that we must understand that Durkheim and Weber are engaged in a long dialogue with the ghost of Marx. They're replying to Marx. And the only Marx they knew was, if you will, the vulgar Marx, the Marx which says economy determines religion and society, which seemed a very depressing picture indeed. Weber is very, very complex. A part of the answer would be to just look at America on the historical level of causation. And there you could clearly see that a number of capitalists, a number of political parties, are strongly influenced by the Calvinist ethic. You could then go on to look at parts of the United States where Calvinist forms of Christianity are particularly strong. I suppose New England would be an area where Calvinist forms of Protestantism are very strong. I'm not completely sure how strong Baptist Christianity is, how much Baptist Christianity derives from Calvinism, and Baptist Christianity is the main influence on the Christianity of the southern states, the Christianity of George Bush. So you can look at it at a historical level. But then again, if you start looking at it at the level of sociological method, you're into a different field altogether, because Weber was not essentially a historian. He was what we now call a historical sociologist. He was trying to aim for a sociological understanding of key historical changes rather than a cause and effect, blow-by-blow account of historical process. At the sociological level, I think what Weber would ask us to do in the United States today is to look at these very particular religious types and compare them with the capitalism growing up. And then what we would see is that in the United States, in certain parts, particularly in the Northeast, there is Episcopalian Christianity, which is much closer to Lutheranism and the Catholic Church, and to a doctrine of service and a doctrine of love, you see. For those who follow the press, that's the part of the United States and the form of Episcopalian Christianity associated with the consecration of the first gay bishop. Mm. But then you look at other parts of the United States and you find an emphasis on hard work being necessary for salvation. Mm. And here Calvinism, of course, is the type of Protestantism being concerned. Then you look at recent anthropological studies of these wild and weird American Christian sects with their prosperity gospel or their gospel of the need to be protected from beings from outer space. And the extraordinary, of course, as you may expect in California, strange, eclectic, hybrid religions which draw on both Christianity and odd notions of outer space in the world. I think what a Weberian method would ask us to do is to look at what these religious psychologies are like on the one hand, and then compare them with what American capitalism is like on the other. Weber is asking us not just to set up ideal types for different forms of Christianity. He's also asking us to set up different forms of ideal type for capitalism. And we're into now, of course, very much a service-oriented capitalism as opposed to a mass production capitalism. I mean, Peter can tell you far more than I about post-Fordist, or Carmel here can tell you much more than I can, about post-Fordist forms of capitalism, where the emphasis is not on mass production, the factory, and the division of labor. The emphasis is rather upon quick shifting between jobs, seizing opportunities through the through information technology. It's on marketing skills, you see. It's much more on marketing than on production. And this kind of very, very ephemeral, quick-changing form of capitalism, with this emphasis on information technology, may have affinities with these rather creative forms of hybrid Christianity, you see, which are terribly individualistic. Weber, in other words, would not ask us to keep on looking at Calvinism. He would rather say, let us look at new forms of Protestantism and see how they may promote new forms of capitalism.
Sure. And he's also looked at different, and the introduction is fantastic, because he tries to close up all the loopholes, in the sense that he looks at different forms of production, different countries and different epochs. So one question which emerges is, what about, therefore, the existence of pre-capitalist, or what we call proto-capitalist work in Italy, for example, Florence. And he says Florence is different from Genoa in that respect, from the coast economies. But he's talking here about the impact of the Protestant Reformation on capitalism as a global system. And he makes a distinction in this work. He says, of course, granted, a lot of capitalistic activity existed in Florence and other places, in the Medici, etc. But the impact now on something as on a massive world system scale, what became a world system scale. And let's not forget, he's not alone in that kind of consideration. Carmel would know, and others. Antonio Gramsci said the same thing. For Antonio Gramsci said, for there to be really socialism, which is what he believed in, you need an intellectual and moral reform of a massive scale. And the last intellectual and moral reform on a massive scale was Protestantism. So even Gramsci posed some kind of relationship between Protestantism and capitalism when he was trying to understand the demise of the revolution, which did not take place in Turin, in Italy, and the rise of fascism. So so we're talking here about capitalism as it evolved on a world scale, as a world system.
I hope I will not derail the discussion. You mentioned Piedmont, Peter. I was thinking about the northeast of Italy, where they are Catholic. They are very much Catholic. In fact, that's the part of Italy where the Duce had its most loyal following. It still is, by the way. There are still followers there. They have shifted to the Lega. Now, there's also a very strong capitalistic development. There has been in the post-war. Mm-hmm. But Catholic. What I was thinking whilst we were talking was this. The kind of industrial development there is based on a small, firm, competitive capitalism, where agency, Dr. Clover were mentioning, is very important. It's the individual who promotes his own activity, along with the family. And this managed to guarantee the support of the church, the Catholic Church. Mm-hmm. DC and Catholic Church, of course, together promote the family. This is a different way of looking.
Yes, I'm not sure. I stand to be clear. I have never seen this work, but I do know of a critique that Amintore Fanfani did of Weber's thesis, where he did refer to places where there was Catholicism was rife. I don't know if he's referring to the same area, where you also had this kind of development. So there is an antithesis to Weber's position by Amintore Fanfani, the former prime minister and president, etc., of Italy, the representative of the centro-sinistra, the DC. So I wonder, I've never seen this work, I have to be honest about it. It's something worth exploring, because I think it's a critique along these lines as well.
In that case, of course, we would have to hypothesize whether it is a Protestantism as such, or whether a certain type of religion that could help. Actually, I was thinking beyond this. I was saying whether religion is not really the cause, it is in itself a tool. Either because a new class, like in Germany, the one referred to by the Protestant area, the Protestant areas. So they need a certain kind of, let's call it, ideology to promote their work, to give meaning to their work. But of course, that kind of ideology could also be a weapon or a tool to impose that class over other classes who do not share the same values. In that case, that would be very close to Gramsci's hegemony thesis.
Yeah.
So it's not a cause, ideas that are the causation of the economy, which is the effect of it, but in reality it is the economy that strangely, in an indirect way, is promoting religion as if it was its glorified divine origin, when in fact is really the weapon that they're using to inflict themselves over the rest of society.
Isn't that Durkheim?
I was seeing this when I started talking. In fact, just one word. I don't know whether politics, because we speak about religion and then we speak about the economy. But somewhere in between there lies politics,
I mean,
and so on.
The classic text, I think, as far as I'm concerned, would be, I don't know, Paul, the elementary reforms of the religious life of Durkheim.
I take Durkheim.
Durkheim's.
These books came out in a similar period of time. But I'm not sure how well Weber knew Durkheim's work, or vice versa. But The Elementary Forms of the Religious Life was published around 1910, 1912, only 7 or 8 years after the Protestant Ethic and the Spirit of Capitalism. And Durkheim's whole position in his last book, Elementary Forms of the Religious Life, was that religions express a very particular social structure, and they express the needs of solidarity in that structure. And as the social structure changes, religion doesn't die. New forms of religion emerge which are more appropriate to expressing the new social structure. That, in essence, put crudely, is the Durkheimian view, And it's parallel to the classical, what I will call for a minute, the classical or crude Marxist view, which is that the mode of production generates certain political ideologies, certain religious beliefs, and certain philosophies or ideas, because it has to. I mean, neither Marx nor Durkheim denied that that people need ideas. They rather sought to say that the ideas must be compatible with the mode of production in the case of Marx and the social structure in the case of Durkheim. How would Weber have reacted to this? Well, Peter has outlined how in Protestant Ethic and the Spirit of Capitalism, his approach is that there should be an affinity between the two. What in his later editions of Protestant Ethic, for example, the 1922 edition of the Protestant Ethic, he prefaces this, his introduction to the 1922 edition, makes the point that the causation can work both ways. The capitalism can promote a new form of Christianity,
or a new
form of Christianity can promote a new form of capitalism. So he's open to the possibility that the causes and the effects may work both ways.
He was very, very concerned about the causality issue. You know, this is not the way, you know, it's a very tentative work, in fact, even the book itself.
I think one of the important things, please, if you have questions here and you want to come in, and do come in, but one of the points which Peter made, which is very important to understand and which we often forget, is that, as you put it very well, the greats left volumes of unpublished work. Marx left his Grundrisse. Weber left Economy and Society, volumes 1 and 2. His whole methodology is now known mainly through his posthumous work. This was his first exploration, and as you say rightly, it was part of a world project, a world study of comparative religions. And it's very worthwhile pointing out that although he did not write about the other religions when he wrote this very specific and short text, he must have been very aware of all his other studies of Hinduism, Buddhism, Islam, when he wrote this text. He had a comparative framework in his mind, even though it doesn't creep into the text. It only shows up in his posthumous work, Economy and Society.
No, there's a lot of reference even in this text which indicate that there, you know, his grasp of these various...
In the 1922 edition, he makes a beautiful... again, as Peter says, he had some beautiful phrases. He says, The queer difference between the West and the rest is that in other religious traditions, people work in order to live. In the Western Protestant tradition, people live in order to work. And these are two very different forms of rationality.
Yeah.
That what is regarded as reasonable existence in many traditions is that work is merely a means to a more interesting, more fulfilled life. Whereas in this very particular tradition, we have the extraordinary idea that you live in order to work. And it's a very different ethos. And he could only have made that kind of statement because he was very aware of other religious traditions.
Yeah, something I would like to say is very tentative as well in the Weberian style. And also, I'm really thinking aloud. I'm no Weber expert. I mean, we wanted to celebrate this particular event. Is that it would be interesting to explore now the impact of British colonialism on a Catholic country like ours. Because what you have here is you've got the, okay, it's a typical Catholic country, which could have gone the way southern Italy went in that respect. In many respects, it was an extension of the Italian south. And then all of a sudden, you've got this imposition of a northern, a Protestant kind of work ethic in a Catholic environment. And that would be something, worth interesting, worth exploring. Because I do think that we have taken on elements of that particular work ethic here in Malta, despite our Catholic background. And one, it would be interesting to look at it historically. I know Carmen has a background in history here, and I don't know, there might be others. I don't know whether the resistance is to this kind of thing. How did this develop? I don't know. If it's something worth exploring, though.
I suppose study has to start from the De La Salle School, probably.
Mm.
And because that's where the...
For the dry dock school.
For the dry docks area especially. But then for the services, I suppose, other
what I'm trying to say is that they could have brought in the Brits, I mean, as our colonizers, elements of the work ethic which would not traditionally be within Catholic environments, if we go by Weber's thesis, I mean, which remains exploratory.
You don't just need religion. I don't suppose Weber actually...
No, religion was...
He didn't isolate everything.
No, and he said himself, it became a mechanistic process.
Like the material resources, and that he mentions them, I suppose. No, I'm sure he mentions
those yes.
other factors. I don't know about the motives. That's a new project which has to
now,
be
we
started.
Now, we have a group of students here, a group of people here, actually, who are specializing in adult education. And I'm trying to draw, it would be interesting to draw a link here. Well, of course, it would be interesting to see what relevance this has to adult education, but the relationship between Protestantism and adult education has been very, very strong historically. So Weber talks about an elective affinity. Protestantism, adult education, and capitalism is extremely strong. For capitalism, you need certain basic skills. One of them is reading and writing, literacy. It is not coincidental that the first massive literacy campaigns in Europe took place were Protestant-oriented. From the 17th century in Scotland and elsewhere, onwards, up to the beginning of the 20th century, from the 20th century, I'm not saying that these did not continue, but then the literacy campaigns which take over and which gain the headlines, so to speak, are more revolutionary, starting from the October Revolution. But before that, before the 20th century, it was all religiously oriented. And you have, of course, in the 18th century, people like Hannah More and the Men de Population, the Sunday schools, which still exist today. You go to England, you see them, Sunday schools, etc. There was always a strong link between religion, why was this person driven, so that you can read the Bible. You have to be literate, because nobody can stand between your conscience and God. So literacy plays a very important part. Even here in Malta, George Preka, in the beginning of the century, although coming from a Catholic background, wanted people to read and write, which means they could interpret religion. That was a minor revolution, so to speak, within the church, when that high status knowledge, which is religion in Malta, was the preserve of an elite. Now, so you have this link between literacy campaigns, Protestantism, literacy campaigns, and development of capitalism, because for the development of capitalist industrialization, you need literary workers. It is no coincidence that, for example, if you take a country like Italy, in the south you had illiteracy goes up to, in certain regions, up to 70%. Whereas in the north, especially in Turin, in the beginning of the century, illiteracy was down to 12%. There's a very strong relationship between industrialization and literacy. Now, the impetus for this was given in Europe by the Protestants, primarily. So there is a link there. So there is a link that we can explore also in adult education in this particular regard.
But it goes further back to the printing of the first Bible.
Pardon? The first Bible.
The first Bible, yeah. which was meant to be available for everyone, not just the elite.
Exactly. Yeah. Because of the big change that Luther brought about, the Protestant Reform, etc. Is that it's you and that creates a certain sense of inner loneliness. Now you can also argue that it also brings about an ethic of individualism, because it's a very, very individualistic approach, which has always been the capitalist ethic, so to speak. But you know, like.
I think we have to distinguish between various strands of Protestantism, as Weber himself did. Clearly, he said Lutheranism was closer to Catholicism than Calvinism was.
Yes, they're both traditionists.
This book, of course, was crucial in pointing out that Calvinism is a marked change, because Calvin had this odd notion that most people were predestined to damnation. Predestination, this extremely pre-modern notion, this extremely pre-modern notion in Weber's paradoxical account leads to an extremely modern result. Because people can only prove to themselves that they are among the elect by hard work and visible evidences of worldly success, acceptance of this pre-modern idea of damnation forces them, or psychologically pressures them, to use Peter's expression, to work extremely hard and to be disciplined in their work. It's not merely hard work, but also disciplined work, and to accumulate, to calculate. So we have this brilliant paradox in Marx, in Weber, that a pre-modern idea, a pre-modern religious idea of damnation, which Catholics never adopted, this notion of predestination of all, produces an exceptionally modern result, which is the calculating man, the accumulating man, and the disciplined man. And the beautiful example in the book is the horrible example of Benjamin Franklin. Preaching that people should watch every second of their day, every penny in their pocket, in order to be morally worthwhile. You know, and there, the Benjamin Franklin case study is perhaps a rather telling example of capitalist forms of individualism. But of course there are many other forms of individualism, but he was primarily interested in capitalist individualism. So when you talk about the adult education movement, I would want to know whether it was Calvinist inspired, Lutheran inspired. That I would like to know more about.
There is a literature really on that, but you know, I mean, I don't think I can answer it now. I have to go back to the literature for that, but there's a whole literature about the campaigns.
You have been listening to a talk in the Work in Progress series, The Protestant Ethic Turns 100. Professor Peter Mayo has spoken about revisiting Weber's Protestant Ethic, a critical exposition.